next time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, welcome to Capital Thinking. Late Happy New Year to everyone. I hope you're tanned, rested, and ready for an exciting 2009. I know here in Washington, D.C., we are gearing up for what will promise to be an extraordinarily busy year on Capitol Hill and the regulatory agencies in the White House and in the legal world in general. We've got a great show for you today. We're going to kick it off with two of our favorite guests. We're joined by Daryl Nuremberg and Stephanie Peters. Daryl is a former chief of staff to United States Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina and now the deputy chairman of the policy department at the law firm of Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C. And Stephanie's a colleague of his there and a former Democratic counsel to the House Judiciary Committee. Daryl and Stephanie, welcome back to the show and Happy New Year. Well, Stephanie, let's start with you, because I know I can, even though we're on the phone here, I can see you grinning from ear to ear that your party is in control, about to be in control of all elements of Washington in just 12 days here. We've got a historic inauguration coming up with the first African-American president. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts and reflections here as we get set for this historic day.
Has made. I think it's historic. The day after Martin Luther King Day, we will inaugurate the first African-American president. It means that our country has come a long way from the past and highlights the continued growth. I think, you know, it also shines a light throughout the world that, you know, democracy is well, and that the United States of America has, you know, shown once again that it is the lead country in showing what people can collectively do. That being said, I will say really quickly that I think with Democrats in charge that the number one issue is getting America moving again economically, and that we need to take our place right behind being the greatest democracy, but also the greatest economic, you know, engine and leader in the world once again as well.
We're going to come back to the economic questions in just a minute, but Daryl, I've asked Stephanie about her grin, so I need to turn around and ask you, where are you hiding for Inauguration Week? Are you and your Republican buddies going somewhere, you know, to sort of drink your sorrows away? And what's the general sentiment of the Republican mood in Washington these days?
Thank you, Kevin, and thank you for having me participate again today. You know, I will be here in town. I will not be in the district. I'll be out in Virginia, but plan to watch on TV and have my children watch as well, because regardless of the results, this is an historic election and a transition is occurring at a very important time in our history, as Stephanie alluded to. And many of the Republicans whom I know are having the same kind of perspective. And the Republicans are finding themselves in an interesting position, Kevin, in that first and foremost of all, what I hear from my colleagues is two things. One is that, you know, the Republicans have issues we need to address in terms of the direction of our party and how we brand ourselves. But second, there seems to be a unanimity that we want Obama to succeed because the stakes right now are so high for our country, and if he does succeed, it will be good for our country. And so there's a lot of talk in Republican circles of not being naysayers, but trying to have our own vision of how to go forward and being more cooperative as opposed to just opposing it on a partisan basis.
Yeah, Daryl, I couldn't agree more with you. I think there's a lot of Republicans who would be happy to see Barack Obama reelected in 4 years, because it would mean that he'd done well enough starting in 2 weeks to get us back on our feet with all these tremendous challenges that he has before him. Lots to do, obviously, right out of the gate here. Stephanie, let me ask you, just 48 hours ago, Nancy Pelosi raised her right hand, was sworn in as the Speaker of the House for a second term, and then swore in the rest of the House, and Vice President Cheney swore in the senators that are joining the Senate for the first time here in the 111th Congress. with a new president and all these issues. Tell us a little bit about what's going on inside the Democratic caucus and what's headlining the Democratic agenda with as they start their congressional session.
Well, clearly I think the economic stimulus package will be the first thing that they address. I don't think, you know, there was a lot of discussion that it would be on this desk the 21st. I do think people realize that it will take a little bit more time and to get everyone's input, you know, including the Republicans' input, that it may be a little further in February. I also think initial bills will include health care, energy, immigration. You've heard President Barack Obama talk about energy-efficient economy and helping to move the economy by working on energy efforts. I think with some of his appointments, like former Senator Daschle, at the Department of Health and Human Services, healthcare is clearly going to be a number one issue for this Congress and needs to be addressed, and hopefully can be addressed in a bipartisan manner. But I think first and foremost is jobs and making sure that people get through this difficult time, that they don't lose their homes, that they can be, you know, productive and everyone can get back on their feet, and some kind of investment in people as well as, you know, corporate America that we have seen a lot of investment in the last 6 months of 2008.
And Daryl, as the economic stimulus discussion gets off the ground here, I see two conflicting things. I see President-elect Obama on Monday reaching out to the minority leadership and saying he wants to work with them. He wants to get 80 votes in the Senate and 350 votes in the House to pass this stimulus and really be a bipartisan bill. At the same time, the next day, Nancy Pelosi has a rules package that seems to limit the power of the minority, and then yesterday they had a hearing that was Democrats only to talk about the economic stimulus solutions. How do Republicans get a seat at the table on what is the biggest issue facing our country right now?
Well, that's another good question. First of all, Republicans will necessarily have a seat at the table because a stimulus package will have to go through the Senate, and at this point, then it's not foreseeable will change. The Democrats do not have 60 votes to push through anything they want on a partisan basis in the Senate. So the Republicans will have a seat at the table. You know, what the Republicans are looking for, Kevin, is they buy into the need of a stimulus package, but they want to make sure that getting there is transparent and includes the opportunity for input from the Republicans, the minority party, because the American people are looking to have bipartisan government, have people work together, and they're looking to have transparency in the process. Now, with respect to the actions taken by the Speaker, that's not at all surprising because, the Speaker is very, very shrewd. She's going to be a very strong Speaker. And one of her goals is to make sure that her junior members do not have to take votes that may make their reelection difficult. They're looking at the lessons of 1992 to 1994, where a liberal agenda was pushed hard and members voted, were forced to vote on issues, and were paid for the election. So what she's looking there in the rules changes are limit the Republicans' ability to offer those kind of amendments. And whereas that's politically shrewd, I think, from a policy standpoint, I think whenever you close out the minority's opportunity to try to shape debate, I think it accrues to the detriment long term.
I got, I think, what time for you guys to talk about one more thing, and I want to turn a little bit to the confirmation process is starting today with Hilda Solis up for labor and Tom Daschle up for Health and Human Services. Stephanie mentioned earlier. Stephanie, you worked in the House on the judiciary side, but can you give us some sense of what sort of counsel you would give to these folks that are walking through the process of Senate confirmation? And Daryl, having worked on a committee in the Senate and had a legal role there, tell us a little bit about the vetting process that goes through the confirmation and what we might expect, where some bumps in the road might be. Stephanie, we start with you.
Yes, I think the process can be a little overwhelming. At the Hispanic Caucus swearing in on Tuesday night, I think Representative Hilda Solis told someone that she's totally overwhelmed, but there are a lot of, as we would say in Washington, old hands that are there to support you through the process. And basically, you just have to be honest about your experience and articulate to the members on the confirmation committee that you have the experience and the commitment to, you know, serve the country in this manner.
And Daryl, on the other side, what's it like to be, you know, the guy writing up the questions for the boss to ask and make that nominee squirm a little bit?
Well, keep in mind that when we're watching the hearings, like so many other things in the Senate, it's just the tip of the iceberg, is that a lot has already occurred beneath the surface, and a lot will continue to occur. By this point, the nominees who are having hearings have had their backgrounds checked and vetted, and they've made their rounds of having private meetings with select members of the committees doing the confirmation. What you're seeing in the hearings, it's an opportunity for members on both sides of the aisle to do two things. Is one, to share with the nominee what the individual senator's personal agenda is, whether that's political or constituent or state-oriented. And second, it's an opportunity to try to get down on the record statements and commitments by the nominee with respect to policy, which could be used later to try to influence the administration and influence Congress in promoting those policies. And those are the things to watch carefully. These hearings will tell us as much about the members and their priorities as it will about the nominee.
Very interesting. Stephanie, we have time just for one more quick question with each of you guys. One thing you think will get done very quickly after the stimulus in this new Congress? If you had to pick one thing to move through both chambers and arrive on the president's desk, what would it be?
I think they will turn and try with health care.
Health care will be the next big thing. Okay. Very good. And Daryl, what do you think is the one or two things that the Republican minority in the Senate will spend their political capital trying to prevent happening?
Card check.
Card check, yeah.
Yeah.
Can you briefly tell us what that is?
Yes. That is a provision which is being promoted by the labor unions, which would replace the current situation where, in order to organize a union in a corporation, the employer can have the option of having employees vote in a secret ballot. The proposal is, in general, to shelve that and instead allow a union to collect cards from employees, and then once they collect more than 50% of the employees' cards, could then petition to be recognized. And it's for Republicans, it's all about the sanctity of secret ballots.
Gotcha. Well, guys, always a pleasure to have both of you on. Stephanie, I know you're going to enjoy some great times at the inaugural. Daryl and I will be watching on the couch. I think, as you said, all Americans are interested in seeing this president and this Congress succeed because the stakes are that high. We'd love to have you guys back on later this year to talk about developments, but we're going to be back in just a moment with more Capital Thinking here on the Voice America Business Network.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
Talk about his money. Call us toll free, 866-472-5790, and talk to the experts. We talk money all the time. Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Parents, did you know that high school dropouts make 42% less than graduates? Someone will have to make up that difference, and chances are, that will be you. That means paying 42% of their groceries.
Ooh, more candy.
42% of their dentist bills.
No, no more candy.
Even 42% of their therapy sessions.
It's all my dad's fault.
Save your money. Encourage your kids to stay in school. For help and advice, call 877-FORAKID. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order. Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Stocks, bonds, 401ks, investments, refinancing. We can help you. Call now toll free. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. Well, if you've been following the debate over the economic stimulus package for the last 2 months or so, you know that a great deal of attention has been focused on the issue of transportation and infrastructure spending. We've all gotten familiar with a new term of art, the so-called shovel-ready projects that might be ready to go if the federal government would just provide some funding to state and local governments to make them happen. Today we're joined by two guests that are at the other end of that shovel, who are going to tell us a little bit about the industry's needs in the stimulus package and what they're working on. Our guests are Dave Bauer, the Senior Vice President for Government Affairs at the American Road and Transportation Builders Association, and Marco Giambardino, who's the Senior Director of Federal Heavy Construction for the Associated General Contractors. So, Dave and Marco, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let me start with you, Dave, and ask you to tell us a little bit about why roads and bridges should be at the top of the priority list for this economic stimulus package.
Well, I think there are two compelling reasons. And first is that for every $1 billion in federal highway investment generates and sustains 34,779 jobs. At the same time, you know, these type of investments aren't just arbitrary activities. They're creating critical assets that are going to provide long-term productivity for the economy and ensure that whatever growth is generated by the economic recovery package is sustained in the future. So it's really a win-win situation.
Well, that's a very precise job number that that ARTBA's got there for...
Oh, that's the U.S. Department of Transportation. They do great work.
Yeah, very good. Well, hey, we actually have an email question here. It's from a guy named Cordell Parvin, who wrote for Road and Bridges magazine for 30 years and is a loyal listener to the show. And he wanted to ask Marco this question. With the downturn in the economy, what have contractors done with their skilled labor? Have they been laid off? And if so, does it take time to get geared back up to work on the new projects after the federal government provides the stimulus funding?
Well, I think it's a great question. The impact of fewer contracts being bid out over the last 2 years has been reflected in the nationwide job numbers. You've got non-residential construction employment, which peaked back in January 2007, and it's decreased steadily over the last 2 years now. We're talking about 180,000 construction employees that are now out of work as a result of that. And our economic forecast looks that if without an economic stimulus package, we're looking at another 10 to 15% loss nationwide if the economy doesn't turn around, which you're talking almost another 30,000 construction employees out of work.
That is a significant number. Let me ask you this. If this package, it looks like it's going to be delayed into February now. Let's say it passes on February 15th. How quickly does this money flow down into the hands of your contractors and road builders to actually get out the door, people are hired, we start to see pavement being laid, et cetera?
We've talked to a lot of our members, and they said once the contracts are awarded, they can begin the processes in place to start hiring subcontractors, ordering equipment, rehiring their workforce, and have folks literally working within 30 days afterwards at the earliest. And I think that shows the increase in federal funding for this type of work will really put people back to work.
Dave, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with everything that Marco just said. I mean, I think there's been a frequent characterization of the potential of including infrastructure funds in an economic recovery package that those projects aren't going to be helpful because they're long-term in general. And I think everything that Marco just said, I totally agree with. The other point here is that, we're not talking about the traditional types of transportation funds that the federal government, even state governments, provide. I mean, everything that is being discussed right now is focused exclusively on getting the dollars out the door quickly. There is no 180 or 120-day user or lose it requirement as being discussed for the stimulus in the economic recovery package for the current federal highway program. I mean, so they are taking steps to ensure that not only are the funds are provided, but they are used quickly, and I think that's a very important distinction.
Yeah, I saw, the Democrats had a steering committee hearing yesterday on the economic package, and Chairman Oberstar, who chairs the House Transportation Infrastructure Committee, as you well know, had some comments that seemed to indicate he wanted to sort of audit the money every 30 days to see if it was going to be spent, and if after 90 days it hadn't gone out, figure out some way to yank it back and perhaps get it into the hands of people who could use it. Well, let me ask you this, guys. We haven't talked cold turkey. What are the numbers that you all are looking for? Each of your associations are out there knocking on doors on the Hill and saying, hey, this is what we need for highways and transit and general infrastructure spending. Let's start with you, Dave.
Really, we have not put a dollar figure out there. I mean, I think that project owners, the state departments of transportation, have said they've got over $60 billion worth of projects that can go in 180 days. Public transit authorities have said they've got $8 billion worth of projects that can go in the same amount of time, and I think the airports have talked about $1 or $2 billion worth of projects they have ready to go. I mean, I think those are all great indicators of the potential that is out there. And, I think our focus is primarily on making sure that, there is a robust infrastructure component in the package and that we build support to actually make that a reality.
Marco, anything different there for you guys?
I would concur with Dave on those numbers. They're right on target. What we have not put together our own numbers. What we are doing is citing the experts, who are the state DOTs and other federal agencies, and to wit, we also have on the drinking water and wastewater side, for wastewater projects, we estimate that there is about $20 billion in ready-to-go projects right now, and for clean water, drinking water, there's an additional $10 billion for projects like levee construction and flood control projects nationwide, particularly in areas down along the Mississippi River and also on the West Coast in California. You're talking upwards of $12 billion of projects that are ready to go.
Marco, I appreciate you adding that. I think we lose sight of the fact that a lot's been focused on bridges and roads, but there's lots of other infrastructure like water and levees that are important as well.
Well, and Kevin, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention building construction, though. You've got probably a $200 billion gap on school construction right now. The average school is about 40 years old, and there's plenty of need out there. There's also probably $2 to $3 billion in federal facility construction as well that can be put to work right away.
Well, we've got time for just a couple more questions, guys. Let me ask you, I know the president-elect has announced he wants no earmarks in this package. And I presume you want the money out one way or another, and you don't have a position on earmarks. But tell us a little bit about, how do you prevent us from having a bridge to nowhere sort of show up in this process at the state level, even if there is an earmarking? And are all these projects, will they have cleared, say, NEPA and other environmental concerns so that, again, they're ready to go, the shovels will be in the ground after the dollars arrive?
That's our definition of ready to go. They've gone through all the permitting. All they're waiting is the funding. And the projects that we're all talking about, all these dollars are projects that have been in need, that have been ready to go. They just haven't had the funding, and that's all they need to get out on the street.
And I think, David, I share that view. And, I think the point that the president-elect and his team are making about transparency and accountability in these funds is basically a fail-safe to the point that you're raising. I mean, if people are going to be able to track how every dollar is spent on the Internet, You know, I think that's a protection to make sure that these are very worthy projects and needed.
Very good. And let me ask you, right behind, right on the heels of this stimulus package, we will crank up the process for the reauthorization of the nation's highway and transit programs. And as you guys are well aware, the Highway Trust Fund basically ran dry late last fiscal year and had to be replenished through not an extraordinary move, but, you know, some money had to be moved from general treasury accounts of the United States government into the Highway Trust Fund. Tell us a little bit about your objectives for reauthorization and how they complement the stimulus discussion.
This is Dave. I mean, I think that, you know, we really see it as a 1-2 punch. I mean, the last thing we want to see is for people to have the perception that the economic recovery package in any way dilutes the need to focus on a robust reauthorization of both the surface transportation programs and the aviation programs, which also has to be done this year. I mean, those are very significant measures that have to go forward. And as you said, the Highway Trust Fund is basically facing a very difficult revenue situation. It's our hope that the stimulus package will provide basically a cushion to allow allow Congress the time and energy to focus on how to address the revenue crisis that's currently facing the ability to meet the nation's transportation needs. And, you know, I think this is one of the very difficult decisions that is faced, that is being talked about, that is facing being faced for the next couple of years.
I think that Dave's got it right, and I think the other aspect to this is that, you know, what we're looking at here in the stimulus package is addressing the needs of the past and the immediate present. What I think our look also to the highway reauthorization is to look to the needs of now and the future. I think that these are exclusive packages, and I think that they will complement each other in a very significant way.
And I, you know, and if I may, I mean, one thing that I really think, you know, is the appropriate way of looking at this is that the recovery package can generate initial activity. It's going to be these multi-year authorizations that have to make sure that that economic activity is sustained, because the last thing we need to do is create a bunch of jobs and then have them go away 9 months from now because we don't have the revenues to be able to support the investment that was started in the package.
David and Marco, thanks for joining us. We'll be back in just a moment with more Capital Thinking.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sell, buy, sell. All we talk about is money. Talk to an expert. Call now. Call now. Toll free 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hey, out of my way!
Welcome to Washington Gridlock. Patton Boggs' legal team can make sense of it all. We know how Washington works. We've been sorting it out for the past 46 years. We have what it takes. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs. We deliver the insights you need to stay on top of your game.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to
Hello.
Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
All
We talk about his money. Call us toll-free, 866-472-5790, and talk to the experts. We talk money all the time. Voice America Business.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, good afternoon. Welcome back to Capital Thinking. We're going to change our perspective now, get out of the domestic policy scene and take a look at the foreign policy arena for the incoming Obama administration. And our distinguished guest this hour is the Honorable Philip Kaplan, former ambassador to the Vienna negotiations on conventional armed forces in Europe, also a former senior advisor to the Secretary of State, now in private practice in the international affairs arena. Ambassador Kaplan, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, listen, we got a little under 2 weeks until Barack Obama is sworn in as the 44th President of the United States. And as I look at my TV screen here in the background, there are shots of UN aid being delivered to Gaza and being cut off by Israel. We've got, you know, a very new conflict there. And yet both the President, President Bush seems to be very quiet about what's going on there, and the President-elect seems to be doing his best to say nothing about what's going on there. Why did this conflict erupt now, and what can we expect to see the United States doing about it in the next couple weeks as we transition administrations?
Well, it's not an accident that the conflict began on the eve of Mr. Obama taking office, just before the end of the term of office of Palestinian Authority President Abbas. In fact, his term is scheduled to end tomorrow. And just before the February 10 Israeli elections, all politics is local, it has been said about the United States, and it's also true in the Middle East. More fundamentally, there are structural, historical, and religious antecedents to this crisis. Israel's occupation of Gaza and then its return to the Palestinian Authority, Hamas's landslide election victory in 2006, Hamas's refusal to recognize Israel and their close ties with Iran. Now, just before Christmas, Hamas ended the ceasefire that had been negotiated and unleashed barrages of missiles into southern Israel. The Israelis, who had emerged from the 2006 Lebanon crisis with a loss of credibility in its military power, determined that they simply had to bring this to an end, both to stop the missiles from coming into southern Israel and to reassert the power of the Israeli Defense Forces for both deterrence purposes and regional stability. The United States has supported the Israeli position that any renewed ceasefire must be sustainable, not just an armistice that would allow Hamas to rearm. And Hamas, for its part, has rejected a new ceasefire. There's going to be a ceasefire. But when it happens, I can tell you that the militants will return, and this confrontation will not go away unless both sides are willing to accept the other's legal and moral existence. One possibly encouraging sign is that Arafat refused to recognize Israel for decades and himself was a terrorist, but finally decided that he had to reach tactical truce. So the question will be, will Hamas do the same? Many Israelis take them at their word and see no way to negotiate with what they consider to be terrorists.
Very interesting. Now, you mentioned that we've got elections coming up in Israel, and I've seen sort of speculation both ways about whether or not the current party in power, which I believe wants the foreign minister elected prime minister now, benefits more from the attack, or if Netanyahu, who's sort of the challenger in this race, benefits more from the Israeli attacks, especially if they don't fully succeed before the election. Can you give us a little more info about that?
Well, your last point is the key one. I believe that with rockets hitting southern Israeli towns, that the foreign minister, Tzipi Livni, who is running because the current Prime Minister, Olmert, is on the verge of being indicted, and so is going to have to leave office. I think she really had absolutely no choice but to pursue a very forceful policy. If the Israelis are able to bring the firings of the rockets to a halt, at least for the short to medium term, she will benefit from that, and the race which presently is favoring Netanyahu will get closer. If, on the other hand, this thing ends anything like the Lebanon confrontation ended a couple of years ago, then Netanyahu's lead will widen, and he'll win a bigger victory.
Interesting. Now, a little bit of a transition here. A lot of people think that Hamas is a pawn in a larger game, that they're being moved on the chessboard by Iran. A lot of people think that's going to be one of the great challenges for President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton, especially as Iran continues with their own nuclear weapons program. There was a lot of talk about Israel potentially bombing the Iranian reactors before Bush left office. Are we closer to a fighting war with Iran, or closer to diplomatic relations? How do you see things dawning with the Obama administration?
Well, it's a very serious challenge. It's been 30 years since Ayatollah Khomeini ousted the Shah. Power in Iran still resides with a tight fundamentalist clergy led by Ayatollah Khomeini. And he has so far backed Ahmadinejad, the radical, extreme current president of the country, for re-election in elections that are due, I believe, in June. Both Hamas and Hezbollah in Lebanon have been employed by Iran as proxies. You're correct on that. And they have succeeded to some degree in destabilizing the region through terrorist methods. And all of this has heightened Iran's role in the Middle East and has caused a destabilizing effect on U.S. interests. In addition to that, as you, I think, mentioned, Iran, which is an energy-rich country, is pressing a nuclear program that President-elect Obama has called a game-changer and unacceptable. The IAEA, President Bush, and the current administration believe that the program is aimed at a nuclear weapons capability. If this is true, it could very well spur nuclear proliferation, a nuclear arms race in the Middle East with the Saudis, Egyptians, Jordanians, and others moving in that direction. And if the Iranian program approaches operational capability, the West is going to face a crisis that could reconfigure the balance of power in the Middle East. I don't think I need to say that a new president would face sobering choices. And he would go to our European allies and seek support, and our European allies will not be very happy about such a prospect. And that will be an issue that we'll have to face. Now, Obama has stressed the importance of diplomatic means to resolve this crisis. And as a former diplomat, I, of course, support that. But we also need to recognize that the U.S. has supported such a European effort to resolve the issue through diplomacy for several years without success. And I'm reminded of the dictum of my former boss, Henry Kissinger, that diplomacy without power invites contempt.
Interesting. So at some point, the talk has to cease if we don't get somewhere with it. Well, let's head a little further east, stick with the nuclear threat, though, and talk a little bit about North Korea. We've seen a lot of multi-party talks in the Bush administration. Of course, China's been a key player in Japan and brokering some of that. But, you know, I think people continue to be fearful of their ability not only to develop a nuclear bomb, but also a missile capacity that threatens Alaska and the West Coast. Tell us a little bit about where you see things headed, again, with the new president and a change in strategy with North Korea.
Well, the fundamental point, Kevin, is that North Korea has been correctly described as a rogue state. It's an insecure, heavily armed regime whose promises in the past have proved unreliable, going all the way back to the discussions with Jimmy Carter. There are open questions about the health of its leader, Kim Jong-il. The population or parts of it face famine conditions. I have personally been at the North-South Korean border crossing at Panmunjom and seen the tunnels that the regime has carved out to facilitate attack. Seoul is an hour's march south from Panmunjom, a quarter of an hour by ear, so it's clearly a very dangerous situation. The Bush administration, as you've indicated, has sought to roll back the North Korean nuclear program through the so-called Six Power Talks with the assistance of China. This diplomatic mechanism has made some on-and-off progress, and has been led by a friend of mine, Chris Hill, who has been the assistant secretary. But the basic question of North Korean nuclear capability and intentions remain open. I suspect that this six-party approach will continue under President Obama unless and until we either reach agreement or face a major crisis with North Korea. But there's no easy alternatives that would end the nuclear program and also keep China and our other allies on board.
I've got about 2 minutes left, Ambassador. I want to ask you sort of a broader question, and that is, where do you see President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton's best chance for success in a foreign policy arena early in their administration, something they can use to build credibility, convince folks that the direction of American foreign policy has changed, and then use that capital to spend on other conflicts elsewhere?
Well, there aren't any easy cards on the table, to be absolutely truthful with you. They're all tough. The president-elect has committed himself to a transition in Iraq, and one hopes to God that as that transition proceeds and troops are drawn down, that it will not lead to a resurgent violence. Afghanistan is, in my judgment, going to be even tougher than Iraq. If you think it's hard to get out of Iraq, where do you see Afghanistan? The Middle East issues are probably not ripe for success. The Palestinian issue, I think we see what's going on in Gaza. People are positioning themselves to protect their interests and their positions there. Iran is going to be a tough issue, but there is at least the possibility that if it's handled correctly, that the Iranians might have an interest in finding some kind of a transition. The hardest issue of all may be the one in Pakistan, where you have a very weak regime with a collapsed economy, the Afghan problem and Al-Qaeda right on their borders, and their conflict with India. It's an absolutely hellish ball of wax. So I have to tell you that I think that the administration is going to come in and try to improve relations with Europe, strengthen our positions with our allies. They're going to appoint some very talented people with a lot of experience to take on each of these individual crises that I've just mentioned and some others under the supervision of the Secretary and the President.
We're going to get cut off here. We've been joined by Ambassador Kaplan. We'll be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking Radio.
Sell, buy, sell. All we talk about is money. Talk to an expert. Call now. Toll free 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Money. Up-to-date business and financial news. Money. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Okay, we're in the stretch run of Capital Thinking this week. Thanks for joining us. Time to talk a little bit about some of the hot topics on Capitol Hill and in Washington in general. I'll start out a little bit with the celebrity sightings of the president-elect who moved to Washington, D.C. this past weekend. He's holed up in the Hay Adams Hotel just across the street from the White House, and he literally stopped traffic on several key arteries on Monday morning so he could take his two daughters to their first day at school, the exclusive Sidwell Friends School in Washington, D.C. And I suspect, given how much traffic he stopped, he won't be taking them to school very often in the years ahead. But it was great that he did that. Now, I know people are excited about Obama coming to Washington on a number of levels. I'll tell you, social Washington's excited because it seems like Obama, President-elect, and Michelle Obama, the incoming First Lady, want to be seen about town in Washington, D.C. I've seen the motorcade roll through town on a number of occasions. Just yesterday, coming out of lunch with a couple of friends, we watched the presidential motorcade move down Pennsylvania Avenue from an appointment that the president-elect had been at back to his hotel, and saw a number of people coming out just to wave at him. I had one friend call me very excited this morning because she got a chance at a reception in the last 48 hours to run across the president-elect, who showed up unexpectedly to greet some incoming senators, and was mobbed by a scene of a couple hundred people. And rather than have his security cordon come around him, he just waded into the crowd and embraced everyone, took pictures with their cell phone cameras, etc. And after 8 years of President Bush, who largely held the city of Washington at arm's length, I think a lot of people are looking excitedly at Obama to embrace them in this fashion, and that builds the kind of political capital he's going to need to spend in the days ahead. Now, with the Republican and Democrats in Congress being sworn in just 48 hours ago, believe it or not, we already have casualties piling up on the list, people who are saying, this is it, I'm out of here. Zach Wamp, a congressman from Tennessee, announcing he's going to run for governor, look for the Republican nomination there in 2 years, and so this is his last term. Pete Hoekstra, a Republican from Michigan, already announcing his retirement. He's thinking about running for governor back there in Michigan. In the Senate, Kay Bailey Hutchison also looking at running for governor in Texas. She's thinking about perhaps stepping down or at least scaling back in the next 2 years as she takes on the sitting incumbent governor, Rick Perry, for a term of office there. And then just this morning, Kit Bond, longtime senior senator from the state of Missouri, has announced he will retire. And that's expected to set off just a hellacious run for that open seat in Missouri. Missouri is a state, if you remember, John McCain won by, I believe, about 1,500 votes out of a couple million cast there in the presidential election in November. That's the first time Missouri is picked wrong in a number of presidential elections. They've always been sort of a bellwether state. As they go, so goes the nation. And they are obviously a 50-50 state, and you'll see someone like Robin Carnahan, who's the well-liked Democratic Secretary of State there and a member of a politically connected family. Her mom was a senator. Her father was a governor. Take a look at running for that. Her brother's a congressman. You'll see perhaps some big names like Roy Blunt, who used to be the number two Republican in the House of Representatives before he stepped down from his leadership position in December. Take a look at running for that seat, or perhaps Sam Graves or Joanne Emerson, also both members of the Republican delegation on the House side, or maybe even Jim Talent, who was the the senator from that state before he lost a couple years ago to Claire McCaskill in a very contentious election. So Missouri is going to be a big focus of the 2010 election, but I think it's an interesting trend. You see a lot of Republicans already realizing that life in the minority with a Democrat in the White House isn't going to be a lot of fun for them on the policy front or on the political front, and they're thinking about looking for other opportunities to run or simply getting out and deciding this is it, they're going to go home and do something else with their career. Now, confirmation season kicks off this week. We've got Hilda Solis, her confirmation hearing scheduled to be the Secretary of Labor. She's a House member from the Los Angeles area. And then Tom Daschle, a former Senate Majority Leader from South Dakota, now a lawyer and advisor here in Washington, D.C., and a close advisor to the Obama campaign through all stages. He was one of Obama's earliest supporters, and several of his key staff members were key staff members of Obama for president. Well, Daschle's up to be Health and Human Services Secretary and quarterback the health care changes expected in this administration. And he should be given the kid glove treatment when he appears in front of his former colleagues this week. Next week, we'll see a number of confirmation hearings, and I think we'll start to see things get contentious, especially as Eric Holder has an experience lined up for him with the Judiciary Committee, as he's scheduled to be the nominee for Attorney General. He'll get roughed up, but at the end of the day, when you've got 58 or perhaps even 59 Democrats scheduled to be in the Senate, the president-elect's going to get his guys through, even if they have to endure a couple days of tough questions. Now, we got still one race up in the air. That's that Minnesota Senate race where Al Franken has been declared the winner by the canvassing board, but Norm Coleman is exercising his legal right to go to court and seek a recount. The distance between the two candidates, about 200 votes out of more than 2.5 million cast. And I think it exposes, once again, some of the problems we had in the state of Florida on election night in 2000 still haven't been resolved at a national level, even though we had a significant piece of legislation called the Help America Vote Act pass in the interim. We still don't have uniform voting standards, uniform ways to review ballots that are disputed, whether or not an X and a cross and a circle means a vote for them. And if you look at how that was handled in Minnesota, you see that it was handled in a way that really a lot of people have a problem with, regardless of which candidate you support, and whether or not there was really a truly nonpartisan review, or if there even can be a nonpartisan review of these disputed ballots, which ballots should come in, which ballots were counted once or twice, which ballots were excluded. And I hope that's one thing that President Obama, in his effort to be transparent and to push for a more accountable system, pushes this Congress to continue looking at how they can impose standards that the states will adhere to that create greater confidence in the voting process for everyone. Let's stick with the Senate and talk about the other great story of the week, and that's Rod Blagojevich's appointment as the Illinois governor, his appointment of Roland Burris to be the new junior senator from Illinois and take the spot for that Barack Obama has vacated. Of course, Blagojevich is under a legal cloud, potentially facing indictment here in the near future. And so initial reaction to Burris's appointment by Senate Democrats was they were absolutely not going to seat him. And Roland Burris showed up with what can only be described as a rolling circus of media coverage on Tuesday, attempting to be sworn in, and he was not allowed to be sworn in. But his well-crafted media campaign, in the course of just 3 days, seemed to have created a 180 in the Democratic caucus in the Senate. Now seems to be a question of not if Roland Burris will be sworn in, but how soon he will be sworn in, and what sort of fig leaf Harry Reid and the Democrats craft to say, well, our hand was forced. I think look for them to have something come in from the Secretary of State of Illinois certifying Roland Burris's appointment, and that for them to say, well, now he's got the paperwork, we can't prevent him from being appointed. All we could do was say he didn't have the right paperwork, and they'll use that perhaps as a graceful way to get out of this ugly situation. But it just goes to show we still have some problems with the appointment process and Congress wanting to stick their nose in. I think that's why a lot of people think we should have the states elect directly in this situation. That does it for this week on Capital Thinking Radio. We'll be back next week with a pre-inaugural special. So join us next Thursday here on the Voice America Business Network.
joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill.
We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.